Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. We were going to begin this morning with a little bit of an overview on guiding principles for the budget process, but I think I'm going to hold off on that conversation till later. Part of what I want to do is make sure that all of us on this subcommittee are relatively on the same page in the direction that we're moving in terms of the principles under which we're going to operate. And so once our colleagues from the Senate arrive, we'll have that discussion. Let's see here. I was supposed to point out that something was handed out.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Before each of the members, to address some of the questions that were at your orientation meeting on Thursday concerning the performance measure linked to benchmark binder that was handed out, there's a memo here from Robin Lamont and Paul Siebert from our office talking about how to use that binder and what it was intended to provide for you. So if there are additional questions after you read through this memo, just let us know and we'll get that for you.
Terrific. Well, first up today is going to be the Oregon Employment Department. Why don't you folks come on up and we'll get ready to go. What I am going to ask is that we allow the Employment Department to go through their presentation with as few questions from us as possible, even though I violated that rule, Senator, this morning, and I fully expect the repercussions, that we hold our questions until the end. We will make sure that there's ample opportunity for all of our questions to be asked, so please write them down. If there is a pressing question, feel free to ask it, but I do want to try and keep this process moving and be able to report back to our co-chairs that we are on schedule and in moving in the direction that they would have us move. So with that, why don't we begin? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Lincoln. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department, and we're excited to be your first agency out of the chute here. You have in front of you a presentation book. It should be a three-ring binder. We are going to do a little bit of skipping around here so that we stay with the guidelines of phase one, but we will continue to refer you to the page number so you don't get lost. But if for some reason we don't do that, please signal us and we'll get you back on track. When we get to our individual programs, I'm going to ask the administrators of those program areas to come up. There are five of them. And we'll be quick, but first I'd like to introduce, sitting behind me is Greg Hickman, our deputy director, and you'll be seeing quite a bit of Greg during these hearings as well. Today and tomorrow we're prepared to talk about our mission, our organization, again the summaries of the five program areas, which will include our performance measures, our agency priorities, as well as our 10% reduction options. So we'll be going through that. If you'll turn to A1 in the presentation book, the mission of the Oregon Employment Department is simply to support business and promote employment. We set it up very specifically that way because business is our primary customer. Business pays the bill through the unemployment insurance taxes that it pays, but it also provides the employment opportunities without which the whole system doesn't work. Job seekers, of course, are a very, very important clients of ours, not only in, unemployment insurance claimants as well, but all job seekers, whether employed or unemployed. The idea of universal access, both for employers and for job seekers, is a very important principle of this whole system. We accomplish this mission in four particular ways. The first of all, first of course, is unemployment insurance. As you are familiar, unemployment insurance is not a needs-based program. It's not a social services program. It's an insurance program, and we insure three different things. First of all, we insure individuals so that they have a safety net when they lose their jobs through no fault of their own. Second, we insure communities so that they can remain viable during periods of downturn. As you are well aware, when there's a big layoff in a community, it's not just the individuals who are harmed. It's the grocery stores and movie theaters and cab companies and everybody else who makes up a community. So we ensure the viability of a community during times of downturn. And the third thing we ensure is the workforce so that we keep a trained and skilled workforce in the area so that when the economy does begin to pick up, they are there ready to go back to work. So supporting the economic stability of, for Oregonians and communities is a very, very important piece of what we do. The second thing we do is to serve businesses by recruiting and referring the best qualified applicants. That is, we help business fulfill their workforce needs by finding and connecting them with the job seekers who've got the appropriate talents and appropriate skills to be part of their workforce. Our goal is to send applicants who are the best qualified. That is, we don't want to be throwing bodies at a job. We want any job seeker and employer to find a win-win situation so that the job seeker is qualified and ready to stay at that job once they get there. So we are very careful to screen as well as we can, determine the skills and the knowledge areas that the job seekers have, and then match them up successfully. The third thing that we do, third major piece of our mission, is to develop and distribute workforce and economic information. We distribute information of all kinds to policymakers, to businesses, to citizens, to support the development of public policy as well as personal career development for people. Our labor market information people are considered, I think, the best in the country. It's an award-winning group of folks. They do everything from the unemployment rate to individual industry analyses for specific regions, and we'll be getting into that in a little bit. And the fourth thing that's critical to a productive workforce is access to safe and high-quality child care. And we do regulate and license child care providers and work with child care resource and referral folks to ensure that workers have the child care necessary to keep them free from worry and productive in the workforce. Next page, we talk a little bit about the historical perspective. Employment services, unemployment insurance, labor market information, and child care are joint federal-state programs. The federal government provides the framework for the system. For the most part, it provides the money. State statutes provide the details that allow us as state policymakers, you and the governor's office, to serve Oregon's particular needs and mold the program to fit what's necessary for Oregonians. Historically, the Employment Service has been around since 1933, the unemployment insurance since 1935. So these programs have been around for a while and have been well tested. And the employment services, one significant period during the 1980s, the federal government began to severely limit funding for those services. And the state legislature and Oregon's business community stepped up in the late 80s and early 90s to develop a funding source that is controlled by state government, and it's called the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund, and we'll be talking about that to some extent when we get into some of these other services. Another major milestone for us is the development of our iMatch skills system, which was rolled out just this past year, which is a web-based and skills-based job matching system, which, again, is cutting-edge technology for the country. Tracy Loudon will be talking with you about the developments in business and employment services. Tracy is our budget officer. Our assistant director for BNES position is vacant, and we are right now recruiting, so Tracy's going to step in and talk to you about our employment services piece. Unemployment insurance was established as part of the Federal Social Security Act, again, back in the 1930s. We've done a lot of exciting things in the past year with provision of services for unemployment insurance, and Tom Byerly, who's our assistant director for UI, will be talking about that. Labor market, as I said, we've been providing statistics for over 50 years. We've got one of the best in the country. To do that, that's provided us with the opportunity to develop and share all sorts of good information using continually advancing technology. Our OLMIS system, Oregon Labor Market Information System, which is on the web, is an excellent site if you haven't looked at it. Has an incredible wealth of information. Graham Slater is the administrator of that division, and we'll be talking with you in a, later on today. And then again, the safety of children who are in child care is critical to the productivity of the workforce. In 1993, that division was moved into the employment department from the Department of Human Services, which allowed the legislature to raise the visibility of the program as well as to highlight its importance to workforce. Tom Olson is the administrator of that division, and we'll be talking about that. The most recent addition to the Employment Department is the Office of Administrative Hearings. In 1999, the idea of a centralized hearings panel was developed allow independent administrative law judges to provide an impartial forum for administrative hearings for a number of agencies. It was placed in the Employment Department partly because unemployment insurance hearings constitutes about half of its workload. And it serves not only UI hearings, but about the hearings needs for about 75 state agencies. And Tom Ewing will be here to talk to you about the OAH. If you'll turn to page A4, the five programs are outlined, give you a rough summary of what they do and how large they are. Unemployment insurance is about our biggest division. It's almost a third of our funding. There are just under 600 FTE being requested for the coming biennium, which is a decrease of 50 FTE. It's a $114 million program for the administration itself. Down at the bottom, there is a tiny footnote that talks about the unemployment insurance benefits. Those are non-limited funds, so they are not part of our limitation. But we administer $1.3 billion of unemployment benefits on the average over a biennium. And so that's part of this budget, but again, it's non-limited money. Business and Employment Services is about a quarter of our funding, and it's an $87 million program, just over 500 FTE. Child care at $124 million is our most has the most money in of our programs. It's got just under 70 FTE. Much of that money is subsidy, which is paid to the Department of Human Services to subsidize daycare for people with a certain at a certain poverty level. So that's the majority of that $124 million. Workforce and Economic Research, also 70 FTE at $12.6 million. And the Office of Administrative Hearings is about $22 million at 124 FTE, mostly administrative law judges. The following page is our org chart. It gives you a little bit of an idea of how these programs fit together and what other kinds of staff we have. I want to point out just a couple of things. The Employment Appeals Board is part of our budget. It is a board of three people appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and they hear the second-level appeals for unemployment insurance hearings of a variety of kinds. Their budget is part of the unemployment insurance division's budget. We have budget and program analysis, a communications and customer access group, and an administration group, as well as the five particular program area groups. And you'll see under Business and Employment Services Division, we have a number of field offices. If you look at page A6, you'll see where those field offices are. We think it's critical to continue our field offices around the state in order to have that community, close community connection, local connection, so that our folks understand the labor market in their particular area and can best serve businesses and job seekers locally by being a part of the communities. Our folks are very, very active in the communities. One of our staff people was mayor of Joseph. Several are chairs of chambers of commerce. So our folks get very, very involved in their communities, understand their communities very well, and that local local connection is important for the success of our business. On page A7, you'll see how we have set up the regionalized unemployment insurance centers. This is part of the story Tom Byerly will be telling you. We have pulled unemployment insurance out of all of these field offices and regionalized them into three centers, Metro, which is in the Milwaukee area, Eugene and Bend, in order to improve customer service and do it, you know, significantly more, less expensively, and with fewer staff. And the regions served by those three centers are marked there. Mr. Chair, if there are no more questions on that quick overview, I would like to ask Tom Byerly to come up and talk about unemployment insurance.
Thank you. Just really quick, when I look at page 86 on your map, purely as an FYI, Hermiston is located in Morrow County and on the map, and it should be located in Umatilla County.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chair. I think that dot got too big.
Although I'll tell you, Morrow County would be more than pleased to accept. Representative Virtue.
Deputy, I just have a quick question on the child care division. You've got 69.5 FTEs. Do you recall the number of child care facilities that get inspected and licensed, just roughly?
Bob Boggle? Let me ask Tom Olson. He does have that on the tip of his tongue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm Tom Olson from the Child Care Division. Approximately 6,000 child care businesses in the state that we regulate. Okay. Those break down about 5,000 family child care and about 1,000 centers.
Okay, great. And just a quick follow-up. Number of serious complaints investigated annually? Just
approximately 800 to 900.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Lincoln, just for clarification, under the child care division, where you spoke of the child care subsidies from DHS, does that reflect in their budget and in yours? In other words, does the money reflect as it comes in that it's from DHS?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, yes, it would. It shows up in ours as being a payment out to DHS, and then DHS would show it as an expenditure, I believe. So it's probably double counted in the budget, if that's what you're wondering.
Okay.
Monica or Satish may know more about that than I do, how it's handled in DHS's budget.
Okay. I'm not sure that it's clear, but we'll just move on, and then maybe perhaps someone else can clarify that point.
We'll talk about that, certainly. Thank you.
Any other question? All righty, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Excuse me. Before we move on, going back and looking at the number of FTEs in the Workforce and Economic Research Division,
mm-hmm.
My question is, has there been any discussion with the folks in the Office of Economic Analysis and BAM with respect to what functions are duplicated in these three different sections, departments, and what could be possibly put into one mm-hmm. economic research department now? And I would have to compliment you. I think the folks you do, the work you folks do is exceptional.
Thank you.
But it looks to me like there might be some duplication here and there.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Morse, I don't think there is. The two groups work very closely together. The Office of Economic Analysis, Tom Patowski and Mike Kennedy and that bunch, do forecast the state revenues and the lottery revenues of the prison. Basically, they use a lot of the information our folks develop. We don't get into any kind of state budget forecast the way they do. We do the economic kinds of things for the state. I'll say that and then ask Graham when he gets up here to talk about his division, just as, to be a little more detailed on how the two work together. But they do work very closely together. I don't see any duplication, but we could always explore that a little further.
Thank you.
Thank you. One last quick thought. When we get into the unemployment insurance division, which I believe is the next tab,
mm-hmm.
I mean, can we get a little clarification on the reduction in those 50 FTE? Why, how, and where the dollars went from there?
Certainly, and that's a good segue into Tom Byerly.
Perfect.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. Initially, I'll just talk a little bit more about our mission. Debbie went over it pretty well. We do see ourselves as an insurance company. We insure three important groups. Initially, as Debbie said, we insure individuals or workers. We provide support to these workers to sustain their families while awaiting their employer to bring them back or while they're seeking new work. We pride ourselves on starting these payments as quickly as possible to help at least some of the stress-related job loss, and we'll talk a little bit about how we are trying to make that even more prompt. Communities is another important group that we insure. During the most recent recession, we infused $1.2 billion annually in calendar years 2002 and 2003 into local communities. That meant workers that were out of work had money to spend at their local grocery stores, their local retailers, the filling stations, what have you, to help those communities stay viable and also to keep their families going while they're bridging the gap between their next job. And, of course, business, by sustaining these workers on unemployment insurance, employers can count on their trained workforce to be ready for them to come back to work when they're able to ramp up to pre-recession levels of production. Mr. Chair, you asked a question about the 50 FTE reduction. Actually, we've done some significant things in unemployment insurance, so I'll touch a little bit on how it's impacting our performance measures in a moment. But prior to 2004, when an individual became unemployed, they would most likely visit one of our offices, one of our field offices. We have 47 field offices. They would go there and fill out a paper application, drop the form off, and then wait to see what happens on their claim. Effective in July of 2004, we moved to a call center mode of service. We started first in Eugene, and as you saw on the map, our Eugene UI Center takes in the southwestern corner of the state, basically from the Cascades up to just south of Salem and over to the coast. And in November, we opened our Portland Metropolitan UI Center, which takes the northwest corner of the state, as shown on the map, and then we'll be opening Bend the first part of April this year in just a few months. By going to a telephone claim delivery, and also we use internet to file initial claims, we can do the work more efficiently. We don't have staff so far dispersed, and so we're able to obtain the economies of scale that result from consolidation of those services. And it's been a real boon to us because we had a tremendous amount of work in 2002, 2003, and it was very tough to keep up with the amount of staff that we had. We had to do a lot of overtime. And so our performance slipped in several areas that you'll note on our pages before. Mr. Chair, does that address your question?
It does. I'll have more questions on it, but we'll wait till we get to the end of the session.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up from there, I'd like to flip over to page B8, if you would, please. Starting on B8, I'm going to be highlighting 7 of the 14 key measures the Employment Department has. The federal government also watches our performance and has acceptable levels of performance for these key measures. The first one there is the first pay timeliness, and that shows how quickly we get the first payment of benefits out to our unemployed customers. The federal level desired level of achievement is 87% of those claims filed get their first payment within 21 days. How are we doing? Well, in June of 2004, you can see there we're right about 89.6%. Since going to the UI Center model, we've actually improved a little bit. At the end of December, we're up to 91.1% timely first payments, which means our customers are getting their checks pretty much, well, quicker than they were before. Some areas where we suffered through the recession and through the other years with lack of staffing and just an overwhelming amount of work, you see in performance measure number 6 there It's the non-monetary separation timeless. Non-monetary, those are our adjudications. And these are our adjudications for those people that have either quit their job or were fired from their job. And so we write a decision and contact the employer and the claimant. And the federal acceptable level of performance there is 80%. We were at 63.7%, pardon me, in June, and we have increased in December 2004 to 68.5%. So it's on a slow upward trend, and again, I'd like to attribute that to the fact that we've consolidated our employees that do the adjudication, our claims adjudicators. We've stepped up the amount of training that we're doing. We train within the centers now rather than send staff out to training, so we're focusing more on getting the consistency and the proper determinations that we're after. Moving over to B9, the performance measure number 7, this relates to the non-separation adjudications that we do, and these types of adjudications are if someone was available for work or if they maybe were injured and unable to work for a period of time, those are the areas we're looking at there. Again, the federal acceptable level of performance is 80%. We were at 67.5 in June 2004, and as we continue to dig out from the backlog in December, we're down to about 65%. That is also going to be on an upward swing as we get the backlog of work cleaned up. Performance measure number 8, down at the bottom of the page. This has to do with the quality of our adjudications. Everything we do is reviewed on a periodic basis to make sure that we're contacting the right individuals and applying the law and administrative rule correctly. The federal level of performance there is 75%. In June of 2004, we were at 59.8%, just under 60% quality. As of September, because we don't have the December numbers yet, we won't have them until February 20th, we're up to 65.6% in that area, and I'd like to attribute that to some of the better training that we're doing. Turning the page to B10, we jumped to measure number 11. Measures 9 and 10 will be covered by Tom Ewing, the Chief Hearing Officer for the Office of Administrative Hearings. The timeliness there is for higher authority appeals. This is for our Employment Appeals Board. Debbie mentioned as a part of our budget. That's the appointed body. The federal level of performance, acceptable level of performance, is 50%. We're exceeding that, but you can see our goals are quite high, and they have been quite high in the past. And the reason for the dip in 2004 was the cleanup of the backlog from the recession. In June 2004, specifically, we're at 54.1% timely. And as of December, there was up to 61.7%, and they're doing their level best to get dug out from the backlog of work. Performance measure number 12 is the timeliness of employer tax reports. This is a pretty self-explanatory. Employer reports are due 30 days following the end of the quarter being recorded. There is no federal level of performance on that yet, but in June of 2004, we were 86.9%. And as of September, we're at 85%. So we're staying pretty much status quo on there.
Tom?
Yes, sir.
Quick question. As you go through these different performance measures, you're talking about the steps that are going to be taken to increase. How did we find ourselves so significantly below the federal standards?
Again, that was a combination of reasons. Number one was the tremendous amount of work we had in unemployment insurance. In 2002, 2003, you probably remember, we were number one, if not the whole time, in the unemployment rate. And we had several extensions. The last legislature approved several state extensions as well as federal extensions. That really took away from some of the adjudications we had. We just simply did not have the staffing authority or the ability to staff up to cover the work. Similarly, by having a distributed service delivery system through the field offices, it was really difficult to keep staff trained, keep them up to date on changes that were coming down the pike. And by having them consolidated again, I have trained UI technician staff on board. They're in the office, and they hold many workshops whenever some sort of administrative rule change comes out, law change comes out, as well as training staff. Now, before you even pick up the phone to take an unemployment insurance claim, you'll get 7 weeks of classroom training in a lab with a PC, with a headset, before you're turned loose to answer the phone. Before you're now fully able to adjudicate an unemployment insurance claim, we're going to provide four months of, again, laboratory training. This is something that we've been needing to do for a long time, and actually through Debbie's leadership, she allowed me to finally do it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Moving over to Performance Measure 13, this is the timeless employer tax payments. Again, pretty self-explanatory. We do quite well in this area. In June of 2004, we were at 95.1% of all the reports were timely, and as of September, it was up to 96.3%.
Mr. Chair, Bender, plus one.
Tom, in an earlier conversation, didn't you represent to me that with the exception of a sand and gravel company out of Corvallis area and an aviation company out of Scappoose, this would be at 100% complete compliance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, I don't recall that conversation, but...
But you're sure it's true?
I could say it'd be possible.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say a word. Actually, sticking with the instructions, I think that's pretty much all I had for unemployment insurance, but I'd be happy to entertain any questions if you had some.
Any questions? Senator Berger.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You've added two people on B-12. I don't think you touched on that. These two positions for the 0305 biennium because your collection of overpayments have not been up to what you wanted. Is that, am I to understand those bullets?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger. These positions were actually given to us by the 2003 legislature in a limited duration fashion, and so we're asking for them to be permanent now because of the amount of collections that they've been gathering. We were going to touch on our packages a little bit later, but that was the basis for it.
I have one follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
And these are contracted out private contractors?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, no, these would be state employees. They work for the Employment Department.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next presentation will be Tracy Loudon with the Business and Employment Services Division, starting on C1.
For the record, my name is Tracy Loudon. I'm the budget manager for the Employment Department. I'm speaking on behalf of the Assistant Director for Business and Employment Services, who is unable to be here today because it's a vacant position. On page C1, we begin the presentation, and with all due respect to my colleagues, I'd like to say that this division is the most rewarding division to work at for the Employment Department. The reason for that, if I could explain that, is we serve businesses by recruiting and referring the best qualified job seekers. Let me tell you why this is such a rewarding program area. Our local office managers speak regularly with local employers and spend time with them at meetings such as local chambers of commerce. There's nothing that makes a manager more proud than when an employer comes up after the meeting and says, "Bob, tell your staff they did a great job last week. They referred an excellent group of candidates for my opening, and I hired a young lady who is just doing wonders." Okay. Now, you can imagine how good the manager feels as he goes back to the office, because he's recalling that a couple of weeks previously, a young mother came into the office who was looking for a job. She came in on Monday, and she talked to one of our staff, and that staff person led her through the exercise of developing a resume, identifying what skills she has that can apply to different occupations. And as they went through that process for a day, they found at the end of the day, they ran her through our iMatch skills process. It's a new system we'll talk more about during our next session. And in that, they identified that she matched a job listing from the local employer. And so they referred her to the local employer, and they called the employer, and the employer said, "Please come down and have her do an interview with us." She went down to the local employer on Tuesday, interviewed for the job, and on Thursday, she was called by that employer and was offered the job. What's really exciting is that many times we have that person come back into the office, and so the young mother comes in. There's a bounce in her step and a twinkle in her eye as she announces to the office in general, "I got the job. I start on Monday." And that's pretty exciting for her because she was worried about where that next employment opportunity was going to be coming from. We serve businesses by referring the best qualified applicants. If you'll please turn to page C9, I'll give you an idea of our performance in this program area. Performance Measure 1 shows a Federal Department of Labor measure of the percentage of people we serve who get a job with a new employer. The national goal is 58%. Oregon is currently performing at 59% and has a goal of 62% within 2 years. On the bottom half of that page is Performance Measure 2, and this is another federal measure that indicates how many of those in Measure 1 are still working 6 months later. It's called a retention goal. Our current retention percentage is 77% compared to a national goal of 72%. As another measure of performance, we ask our customers about their satisfaction with our services. Page C10 shows that 89% of employers rate our services as good or excellent, and 94% of job seekers give us a similar rating for our services. We anticipate that though these are both excellent reports on our services, that our customers will see increasing levels of satisfaction in the years to come, because we're all about getting people into jobs. That concludes my presentation ad hoc this afternoon. Do you have any questions for me on this program area?
Well, I want to share with this committee very quickly that at the beginning of the session, I had contacted the employment department looking for a person. And I have to tell you, the process they took us through was just excellent. It was very responsive, met my needs, ended up sending me a whole slew of folks, all of which were qualified. And then, so I was very pleased there. Then I also have to share with you about 2 weeks ago, I had a little too much free time on my hands. And so I got on the computer and emailed over to them saying, please send me information. Didn't identify myself, but just said, this is the date, this is the number. And literally within, I think I did about 7:30 in the morning, by 10 a.m., I was receiving a phone call. And so to me, that's just one measure of the work they're doing. So, any questions?
Just my only experience is I applied for help through the agency and found out I was unemployable. But other than that, I've got a high regard for them.
Representative Richardson.
I'd just like to commend you on the work that you're doing and how valuable it is with our work that we're doing on human services, because there's 1,000 programs, but most of them would be solved if there was a good job. I mean, not most, you know, I'm just talking about those that have the ability to be lifted. It helps with the family. It helps with family problems, children problems, all this, when there's a family unit that can afford to pay the bills and spend the time that they need on other things instead of just worrying about getting by. So nothing is more important than what you're doing as far as the solidity and success of families.
One of the things I'm going to open up as an opportunity for this committee is, as we progress down the line, I want to make sure that we're bringing in the economic development folks, the housing folks, you folks, to sit around a table and to join us in a discussion on, are we making sure that we're integrating all of these departments as thoroughly as we should? And maybe the answer is yes. I don't know, but I do want to have that discussion in the future. Thank you.
Glad to. Thank you. Our next division is child care division, and Tom Molson will be back up to talk more about what he's doing with child care.
As you're coming, I believe I'm compelled to remind the group that child care will also be discussed within the Department of Human Services arena, and I think you folks are going to really dig in on these issues. So,
Monica.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I could expand on that. The co-chairs mentioned this morning, as they were reviewing this agency's budget, that they did, in the area of child care, want the Human Services Subcommittee to also have an opportunity to hear from you folks so they could prioritize, since a large portion of the money is passed through to Department of Human Services. They also commented that we will make you aware when Community Colleges is up before the Education Subcommittee, so that you can be familiar and maybe potentially listen in on those subcommittees and get the information about workforce investment partners and how they integrate with these folks. And that may be something you want to hear some more about from the department as well, when time allows.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Tom Olson, Administrator of the Child Care Division, and I'm very pleased to be talking with you about what we do. Mr. Byerly told you that that they see themselves, and in fact they are, an insurance program. And in a lot of ways, the child care division, we see ourselves as their insurance program also. We ensure that low-income working families have access to child care by providing subsidies through the Department of Human Services. We also ensure that anyone, no matter what their income is, has access to high-quality, safe child care so that they can go to work. There's no, I think there's probably no one in the entire child care division, and we're a very large partnership. There are a lot of agencies that work together very closely, and a lot of outside advocates and organizations. I don't think there's anyone that would tell you that the best possible situation for a child is to be in a child care facility. It's always better, we believe, for a child to be cared for by a parent, if possible, or by relatives, if possible, extended families. I think this, all of us know that that is not the reality of today's world. A lot of folks are raising kids as single parents, and a lot of folks just don't have the access to the extended family that we had 20 years ago. So child care has become an extremely important issue for the workforce and for society at large. We see ourselves as very much of a workforce program. People always ask, why is childcare in the employment department? Well, number one, of course, there's today's workforce, the people that have to have childcare in order to work. There's the workforce of the future. That, of course, is the children. And the new research on brain development shows that children's brains develop more between the time that they're born and 3 years old than at any other time in their history. And while we have them in child care settings, they really do learn a lot. And if we can provide them with quality learning environments, we're going to help to ensure that the workforce of tomorrow is high quality also. And our third workforce connection, of course, is to the child care workforce. We employ about 15,000 people in child care in Oregon. That's a fairly large economic impact. And those 15,000 people used to be thought of as babysitters. Child care is not babysitting. It's too important to be babysitting. Like I say, the kids are learning no matter where they are. Sometimes they're learning things that shouldn't, that aren't necessarily good, but they are learning. And so our mission is to try to make sure that what they learn is proper, is high quality, and is preparing them for the future. We have about...
Senator Johnson.
I'm going to keep focusing on this absent an answer, and so I might as well interrupt and ask. How many daycare or child care programs are there scattered throughout state government? You have responsibility for licensing the facilities, but as far as paying for access to daycare, how many programs are there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, there are two programs that really subsidize child care. We, through the Employment Department, run a small subsidy program for what we call targeted populations. And those are migrant and seasonal farm worker families. There are parents in alcohol and substance abuse treatment programs. There are parents that have children with special needs, and there are student parents. Then we contract with the Department of Human Services to provide child care subsidies to low-income working families, and that's where the majority of our budget goes. And it is a contract. We work very closely with them to make sure that the child care that kids receive meets standards and make sure that the payments are adequate and timely.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I was surprised to see the math recently on the student-parent program, and while I take no exception to the concept behind it, I was surprised to see how many people were served for the amount of money that's in the program. I was surprised to see how few people were served by the program. Are the subsidies paid across your programs roughly the same, or do they differ in the benefit afforded?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, they're roughly the same. We pay subsidies based on what's known as a market rate study. Every state is required to do by the federal government. To do a market rate study every 2 years. Most of the money that's in child care in Oregon, 97% of it, is in fact federal funds. And so we do the market rate study to see what sort of payment rates that we're operating on in the state. Market rate study, the way the federal government looks at it is that a family with a subsidy check in their hand should be able to afford 75% of the child care slots in the community. Another way of saying that is if you have a child care subsidy, you should be, if you, and there's 100 child care providers in the community, you should be able to have access to 75 of them. Oregon is far, far below that target. And we try to allocate our money so that everybody gets a little bit. But we right now, we pay it more like the 24th percentile of the market rate.
Thank you.
Senator Berger.
I'd like to follow up just a little bit on that. At Southwestern, there is a student parent child care. I believe it's Montessori. I believe that it only will accept those that are low income. And I'm kind of curious as to why there are students who would be willing to pay that that tell me that they cannot go to the program. Also, there are people in the public that work that would be willing to go to the program. Do you have some kind of limits in that that also limit your funding, or is it a federal guidelines?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, we try to make it as accessible as possible. Each program, of course, has its own requirements. Some programs, for instance, like preschool programs, aren't required to be licensed by the child care division. And those programs that we license, we can't really compel them to take a certain percentage of low-income families. Some programs do take low-income families. Some folks don't, but we have no way of getting into their businesses and saying how it is that they can operate, because again, it's a market economy, and what we're doing is regulating businesses.
I see.
Continue.
Thank you. We have, as I mentioned before, about 6,000 child care businesses in the state. We have a total of 74 positions that are responsible for regulating those positions, or those facilities. And when I talk about child care facilities, a lot of them have more than one operator. Family child care is operated by usually by the person who owns the home. But in child care centers, they often have a lot of staff. We also maintain a criminal history registry for all child care workers in the state, and that the total on our registry is between 30 and 40,000 child care workers. So our staff are divided between checking applications, checking requirements, doing criminal history checks background checks on providers, and also between doing inspections, physical on-site inspections of child care facilities. So we have approximately 42 staff in the field whose job it is to actually go into child care homes and do inspections. And as you can imagine, 6,000 child care homes is a lot of workload. But as you'll note on our performance measures, our performance measure is that we do 100% of health and safety reviews at every child care facility in the state, and we've always met that, and hopefully we always will. We set it at 100%, we keep it at 100%, and the reason we have that performance measure is that if I should ever come back before you and say, I'm sorry, we're not regulating 100% of the child care facilities, you should ask me why, because health and safety of kids is the most important thing that we do. Affordability of child care, of course, is important also, and that's what we address through our targeted population programs and through our contract with the Department of Human Services. Quality of child care is also important. We spend as much money as we can on that because we find that it's very important. Children really do learn a lot in child care, and the single best indicator of whether or not a child care setting is of high quality is the education and training of providers. So we spend a lot of time and a lot of effort trying to provide training for providers, making it accessible to them, making it affordable to them, and giving them incentives where we can to make sure that the training is taken. We've worked very closely with Oregon's Child Care Resource and Referral System. They're kind of like our eyes and ears in the field. They're the ones that actually deliver child care services to parents, businesses, and families. Child Care Resource and Referral is a statutory responsibility for us. And we have 17 of these agencies across the state. They're generally located in either a community action agency or a community college. And their job is to provide child care referrals to parents, to provide work-life information to businesses to maintain a database of the child care supply in their community so that they know whether they're at or below the amount of child care that they should probably have for the number of kids they have, and to work to improve the quality of child care by coordinating training. If it were not for the child care resource and referral agencies, the child care division would probably be have to be three times the size that it is, because they really do the work on the field, in the field, on the ground, working with parents and families. And I think that concludes my presentation, and I'd be glad to take any questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Our next division is the Office of Administrative Hearings, and Tom Ewing is the Chief Administrative Law Judge in charge of that division.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Ewing. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings. I don't know how many, we're a relatively new organization, and I'm going to assume not a lot of knowledge about us, and so I'd like to begin, if I may, with a story. And the name is fictitional, but the story is not. We have a woman physician, a Dr. Helen Smith, who is licensed by one of the health licensing boards. One day, she receives in the mail a notice from that board proposing to revoke her license. She's not happy. She hires a lawyer, and on the day of hearing, she walks into the hearing room, and there presiding over the hearing itself is the very board that wanted to revoke her license in the first place. And representing the board is an assistant attorney general, there to persuade the board to do what it really wants to do anyway. With that in mind, a few years ago, Senator Neil Bryant and Representative Lane Shetterly thought that there was a better way. They sponsored legislation in 1999 that created the Office of Administrative Hearings, then known as the Hearing Officer Panel. We have approximately 124 employees. We hear cases, I think there were about 37 cases that were referred to us last year. If you have an interest in the source of those cases, on page E3 is a pie chart. The principal exceptions from are cases that we do not hear: Workers' Compensation Board, Public Utilities Commission, Employment Relations Board, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The breadth of our subject matter is very great indeed. We hear unemployment insurance cases, special education, food stamps, drunken driving, fish and wildlife cases, Department of Agriculture, professional licensing boards, all of them, Board of Psychologists Examiners, for example, Board of Examiners for Speech Pathology and Otology, the Chiropractors, Board of Medical Examiners, the list goes on. One of the things I would like to talk to you about is cost savings, and if I can refer you to page E8 at the bottom. These are, well, let me just a brief background. For 20 years, there have been efforts in Oregon to create a central panel. And by central panel, I should have explained, and my apologies, what a central panel is. The idea of a central panel, we're one of 22 in the nation, is to take the administrative law judges out of the agencies which employ them, out of the agencies whose hearings they do, and put them into an independent and impartial organization, here, the Office of Administrative Hearings. The idea has been floating in the legislature for 20 years. One of the principal deterrents to that, and one of the principal arguments against it back in 1999, was costs. The fear was, and it was understandable, that a central panel would be a new bureaucracy, and an expensive bureaucracy at that. What the document or that chart does, this table, which is called the operational indicators, it is a table that looks at the interplay between referrals to the OEH, hours billed, we bill for services just like the Department of Justice, and the cost per referral. If you look at 0001, the first fiscal year of our existence, the average cost of a referral was $322. The average hours billed for a referral was just over 8.5. And you can see in each year, the numbers have improved. Costs have gone down until, in this last rolling 12, $276 per referral, just under 7 hours per referral. Now, I would, if I could, I would love to take credit for that. I really can't, in principally at least. The real reason why, for the efficiency of the OEH is simply the economies of scale. Just as an automobile plant producing 10,000 automobiles a year can do so at a unit rate more cheaply than one producing 1,000, so an Office of Administrative Hearings or a central panel such as ours issuing 37,000 orders a year can do so more efficiently than one issuing 3,700 a year. But I would say, too, that right from the beginning, the management of the OEH has dedicated itself to looking for efficiencies wherever we can. So efficiencies, too, account for some of these cost reductions. We have been trying to reduce traveling throughout the state for implied consent hearings. We have expanded cross-training in all of our different subject matters. So as hearings decrease in one particular area, we're able to move those judges into another area where hearings have increased. We've been issuing summary determinations for certain kinds of orders where they're appropriate. We've been designing or recreating, in fact, our legacy case management systems that were wholly inadequate to the task. One of the things I'm very proud of, it goes less to efficiency but more to customer service, is our website. I've been in private practice, and I represented clients at administrative hearings, and there is nothing more frustrating for a lawyer, at least in my experience, than to go to the agency and ask, all right, what final orders do you have in the past? They'll give me some guidance as to how to shape my case, and indeed whether I have a case at all. Few agencies, very few, kept any final orders at all. I did not think that was a good way to serve the public. So what we have been doing, right from the beginning, I knew this was what I wanted to do. We have kept all of our proposed orders. We have collected all the final orders. And we are putting orders up just as quickly as we can. We have a number of up right now. I've been very pleased with this. And there are some other things we've done. We've put all the statutes and rules for all 75 agencies. It did not seem to me to be the right thing for a citizen, particularly an unrepresented one. And that's whom mainly we serve. Do not really have a clue. He or she may see an OAR number, but not know what it is. So this is a fast way to get you directly into that statute or rule that is applicable in your particular case. So I've been very pleased with this website. I'd like to talk about timeliness of orders. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think we all agree that not only must orders be legally accurate, they need to be timely. The public depends upon us. What is at issue in our hearings are eligibility for example, unemployment insurance benefits, for medical services. We cannot wait. One of the things I think that distinguishes the administrative process from the judicial process is that in the latter, it moves, frankly, at a glacial pace too often. And this is because of complex evidentiary rules, because of complex procedural rules, and perhaps for other reasons. In administrative law, we move at a very speedy pace. On pages E6 to E8 is a report, a table of all of the subject matters for which we hold hearings. We have identified the either statutory or regulatory timelines that we need to meet. If there are no timelines, then we self-impose them, generally 45 days. Now, I will say, not by way of apology, but by way of explanation, that in the first couple of years of our operation, of my appointment, I've been focusing on operational matters, on efficiencies, and on the quality of our orders. In this last year, I have been focusing now on timeliness. We have a ways to go, certainly, but our timeliness over the last three quarters has improved. If I give you an example, unemployment insurance benefits. In the first quarter, we were the major standard, the first timeline standard is 60 days, or 60% within a certain period. We were at 39%. In the second quarter and third quarter, we've gone up to 72% and 70%, which is considerably above the minimum. I think for this last quarter, we'll be hitting 80%. So we're doing much better there.
Let me ask a few questions here.
Yes, sir.
Just so I'm clear.
Mm-hmm.
When a hearing is conducted and Helen Smith comes into the hearing and she represents herself, who... Traditionally, which of these agencies, with these agencies, who represents the agency at a hearing?
For Department of Human Services, typically it will be an agency representative. For unemployment insurance, there really is no representative from the department. It depends on the nature of the case. For other kinds of cases, let's think principally the professional licensing agencies, they will be almost always represented by an assistant attorney general. Oregon Liquor Control Commission, for example, its hearings are represented by, generally, by an assistant attorney general. So there's either no representation, representation by an agency representative, or thirdly, by an assistant attorney general.
And who determines what form of representation the state's going to have?
That's determined, Mr. Chairman, by the agency itself. We don't offer any opinion on that. That's the agency's call.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not an entirely rhetorical question, but has anybody ever considered moving the Land Use Board of Appeals into the Office of Administrative Hearings? The kind of performance that you're generating is something that would be unheard of in the Land Use Board of Appeals. You've got all of the rules, Mr. Chairman. Most of the findings are based on, you know, administrative rules and statutes, which obviously you follow with your panel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, that is something that I am very careful to stay out of. That is your decision and the governor's. I offer no opinion on that.
Was that a motion, Frank?
Well, I would, Mr. Chairman, I would offer that as a possible thought to pursue with the co-chairs.
Ready?
In your leadership planning. Or within the leadership group.
Mm-hmm. Senator Westland.
Do you have a response?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, let us look back at the discussion in 1999. There was a lot of who should be in and who should be out, and I don't know if LUBA was ever considered to be in, but we'll take a look at that. The Workers' Comp Board, for example, was kept out specifically, so we'll take a look at that and see if they were ever considered. At least bring that back.
Yeah. As I recall, and I think, didn't Shetterly and Bryant get this going in 97 and actually get it across both floors and Kitzhaber veto it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, that's correct. House Bill 2948 passed overwhelmingly by both chambers of the legislature. The governor vetoed it for probably principally two reasons. One, he felt that a central panel was a solution looking for a problem. And secondly, but more importantly, he was very concerned about costs.
And I do remember that was the big discussion. I mean, who was in, who was out. Some wanted to be in, some wanted to be out. But I think that would be very helpful as look back to the records and see some of the notes. Because I think Frank's got a pretty good idea.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, I'm about as familiar with the records, the history of the OEH as anybody. I've just written two articles on our history. There is nothing there that explains directly why, whether in fact LUBA was considered or not, and why not brought a part of it. I think my best answer is right now, and I'm happy to go back with Debbie and take a look. There were some policy choices made, particularly by Chip Lazenby and Lane Shetterly. They didn't want to have any agency whose head was an elected official, hence Boley not being included. They felt sort of more by instinct than anything else that there were certain programs that were just seemed complex that they did not want to put in the OAH. I suspect that was the reason for land use, which is his own specialty. I think probably Chip and Lane would be the best sources, so we will go back and find out.
And then, please follow up.
Then also at the bottom of E9 where you have the OAH customer results, I see, you know, if you look up at the agency results, you go down the not satisfied column, and you know, you got some 1s, 2s, 4s, 5s, and overall it was 3. You look at the customer results, and you see 7, 15, 13, 0, and then overall satisfaction was, not being satisfied, was 19. Do you have an explanation of that other than the fact that people were getting, you know, ruled against?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, that is my explanation. Let me just say, if I may, that we have been, this represents only a very narrow slice of the cases we do. With 37,000 hearings, it would be prohibitively expensive to be sending out these surveys to everybody. So what we have done is we have picked them for the board and commission cases principally. Well, in fact, entirely. And I look at each and every one. I read each and every completed survey. Where citizens are not happy, it is 99% of the time because they don't really understand the law. Let me give you an example. I listened to the tape. I just received a scathing survey from a citizen. I felt important enough that I listened to the hearing tape. The citizen complained that the administrative law judge did not allow her to present her case, was rude, and cut her off. I listened to the hearing. I'd say quite the contrary. The administrative law judge, frankly, was a model of forbearance and patience, but did finally have to take control of the hearing because this citizen felt that the issue was here, and in fact, the legal issue was over here. I've been surprised, actually, at how many citizens, how much the public has been pleased with our performance or satisfied with our performance, even when they lose. That has really surprised me.
Follow up.
These surveys, this is self-selecting? So you send them out and just whoever sends them back, that's what you compilate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, yes, that is correct. So it is not a scientific survey. But I use it because it gives me a pulse of how we're doing on one part of our service, and I can extrapolate more broadly to the rest of the OAH.
Well, I could just say, of all the massive, slow-moving cogs and wheels of government, I think you are one of the shining spokes that is not widely recognized, and you guys do a tremendous job, and it's not just legislation, it's how that legislation and the concept and the spirit of which has been executed, and for that I thank you.
Thank you, sir. Very kind.
Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the 124 FTEs, how many are admitted to the bar?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, a very, very good question. Answer your question directly. Most are either admitted to the bar currently or in the past or have law school educations. And increasingly, we have been moving more and more in that direction. Currently, the minimum qualifications do not require a person to be a law school graduate. But the law has become far more complicated in the last 20 years, as the attorneys on this committee know, and it's becoming more and more important for administrative law judges to have a legal education and preferably even experience. I think the best ALJs are those who have actually practiced law.
Quick question, then I'll go to you, Senator Johnson. Who pays the cost of a hearing?
Mr. Chairman, we bill for services on an hourly basis, much like private attorneys, much like the Department of Justice. And so this is one of the benefits of the Office of Administrative Hearing, because agencies are not continuing to have to pay for personnel that, frankly, that they do not use when hearings go down. But as they refer a case to us, as we process it, as we hear it, we will bill per hour to the agency.
So the public who might make an appeal is not billed?
Mr. Chairman, the public is not billed at all. This is taxpayer money.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. From looking at the pattern of the kind of cases that you handle in any of your issue areas, are you or your colleagues ever accidentally or intentionally able to discern places where you might make recommendations to the agency about aspects of the agency's business? Let me make this a little less vague. I sort of take the temperature of what's going on in agencies by listening to constituent issues, and it seems recently I've had a spate of constituents who have tangled with the agency over the overpayment of benefits, and then the question of how is that resolved. Do you see any patterns in looking at your cases that might cause you to want to offer recommendations to management or even to the legislature?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, what a good question. I will tell you, I have been very lucky to have Debbie Lincoln as my boss and Greg Hickman, because they have been careful to keep me out of policy matters. I feel strongly that our mission is to be independent and impartial and to stay out of policy, to apply the law as you ladies and gentlemen have written it. I will make recommendations about procedure if we can improve the procedural processing of hearings. Beyond that, I stay out of it, and the short answer is that no, I do not make recommendations. These agencies see these orders, they see how we've ruled, and it seems not my place to tell them how, you know, to run their business, I guess.
Exceedingly diplomatic answer. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lincoln, in your review of the pattern from any of the cases, do you see any areas where management might change their practices or offer legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, Tom handed me a note. There is a House Bill 2126 which addresses some of this. But, yes, we do. Tom Marley and his folks track hearings and the kinds of things that come out and patterns and address those as we see something developing that needs to be fixed. So we consider that to be a learning opportunity as well, not only what the Office of Administrative Hearings sees, but also what the Employment Appeals Board sees if it gets into the policy issue at the higher appeal level. So, yes, we use that to inform our policy making, particularly around administrative rulemaking.
Thank you.
Senator Westland.
You can tell by Mrs. Lincoln's gloved right hand, bandaged right hand, that she's had some of those discussions with her manager.
Yeah.
Please no
continue.
Comment, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, I've forgotten the question came from Senator Westland. I was going to talk about the customer satisfaction and refer you to Exhibit E9, but really that concludes my presentation, and I'm delighted to take any more questions. The Office of Administrative Hearings is, after all, my favorite subject. I have a passion about it, so I'm to talk about it all day. With that, I conclude.
Thank you. Senator Morris, would you be willing to receive additional information on the question you posed?
Certainly.
Would you folks be willing to get Senator Morris
Definitely.
That information?
Mr. Chair, we'll bring some information back.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our last program area is the Workforce and Economic Research Division, and Graham Slater will provide you some information on that. And we are to Section F1 in the book.
Howdy, Graham.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be in front of you again and to provide brief information on what we do in the economic research area. Senator Morris, I'll get to your question a little bit further through, if that's okay. Quality information, informed choices. That's a phrase that we use a lot in our area, and the summary there is that it's our job to provide the very best quality of information about the economy, about the workforce that we can, and then it's up to all of the customers that use us to make good business decisions. Business decisions, career decisions, transportation planning, to name some of our customers, educational course offerings, and I'll give you some examples as we go through. In preparation for today, I asked some of our staff, particularly, what have they done in the last few weeks that might be of interest to you, and here's just a few examples. One of them presented economic information to the Clatsop Columbia Tillamook Workforce Investment Board, an overview of that area's economy and projections, and also shared with them a new website, a new data series that Oregon and Illinois have been the lead states on with the U.S. Census Bureau. And this morning I just happened to get an email, and this was from a private sector national economic consulting firm, and it says this, a direct quote, "We seldom use the terms revolutionary and data in the same breath. But once you use this site, you'll know why this one does things like no one else on the web." And it's a site that helps us learn about commuting patterns and turnover and the demographics of the workforce, older workers, minority workers, and so on, information that's never been available before. We presented in the South Coast, down in the Coos Bay area, at an economic and business outlook conference. More than 240 business and community leaders were there. And the simple comment I'd make on that is that without the work of our division, we wouldn't know anything about what's going on in Coos County and Curry County, because most of the national and even the Tom Petowski groups, they're looking at the statewide picture. So we're the ones, not only do we do a lot of statewide work, but we go down to the counties and the workforce regions of the state. A couple of weeks ago, one of our staff gave a presentation to the Albany Kiwanis Club, Linn County's Economic Overview, and we do a lot of presentations every year. And I just want to share from personal experience that every one of those presentations results in more requests for information, more requests for presentations, more requests from businesses. So we come back to our office, and especially those outstation staff, they're then spending the next day or two following up on the requests that they get. We helped prepare, and we presented at a mini-summit over in the Bend area of the secondary wood products industry. And we participated in the follow-up meetings presented at the Leadership Redmond Group over there. In Representative Smith's area, I had a note, provided wage information to a family farm owner in Umatilla County. Sometimes it's presentations to 240 people. Other times it's a phone call from someone who says, "I have an opening, I have no idea how much to pay for this position. I've never recruited for this before. What's the average? What's the high? What's the low?" And so that was one example. We also played a big role in information providing for a manufacturing company that decided to relocate to LeGrand. And I'll share a little bit more on that one later. And then in the LeGrand area also, the Training and Employment Consortium recently sent us an email, and here's another direct quote, that our information was essential in assisting them in acquiring additional funding to serve an additional 30 dislocated workers in Baker, Union, and Wallowa counties. Again, they wouldn't have had that information, Senator Johnson.
I think that's great stuff, and I've been in some of the presentations where your people have provided data. In addition, I was a former board member of the Federal Reserve Bank in Portland, and I send on your data as I routinely get it. I send it on to the Fed for their consideration. Having said that, I want to drill down a little farther in a direction that Senator Morris started out, and that is that I hear frequently from folks that as they come into the state of Oregon, they are unable to get the kind of information that you routinely provide in trying to make location or relocation decisions. And I'm interested if you could share with us a little bit about how your data is used by Oregon Economic and Community Development to do any of these job recruitments or make presentations about the current state of the economy that might inform business decisions.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I'd be happy to. Let me go back to the LeGrand example, because that is a perfect one. That's exactly what it was used for. And here's the types of information we provided from a real case. Mm-hmm. Labor force availability, that's a huge one. And we get requests by occupation where a company will say, "I'm going to need this many welders, this many machinists, this many whatever it is. Is there any remote chance that I'm even going to find those workers in this area of the state, be it Portland or LeGrand or any place else?"
With the chair's indulgence,
please.
Are you then providing this information to the requester, or are you giving it to Oregon Economic and Community Development and they're passing it on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it varies. Most of the time, I would say that we're providing it to the state economic development or the local economic development folks, depending who's in the room at the time. Quite often, our folks are also in the room, and some of these are highly secret. Often, I don't even know the companies involved. So one of our outstation folks, the person in Baker City, for example, she may be invited to meetings where she may not even know the company either because it's all highly secret. She may be there making that presentation with company representatives of the company that are considering coming here. Or at times we do. We just give it to the regional development officers at economic development, and they may use it themselves. So it just depends on their needs. We do work closely, I might add, with Ron Fox and the economic development folks and make presentations at their staff meetings. So there's a kind of collaboration there also.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Continuing then, Mr. Chair, just a couple more examples. I asked our workforce analyst, which is one of our positions that particularly focuses on serving businesses. Our person in the Beaverton office told me about several businesses just in the last couple of weeks that he's provided information to. And again, it's a huge range of information: population, income, wages, labor shortage, cost of living. And these were companies across banking, food products, telecommunications, high-tech, and recreation industries. And that's just literally in the last 2 or 3 weeks. The final one, down in the Medford area, we provided the economic information that resulted in a $400,000 youth grant that went down to the Medford area with a potential of a $700,000 per year to continue the grant. And again, our input was important for that. We also helped coordinate a small business fair down in Medford last year, and I think Representative Richardson actually spoke at that one. Those are just some examples of the way that our information is used. And I guess the point I want to make is that it's everything from the hard numbers of a new company moving into town, because we've shown them that there is a workforce or there is the training facilities or whatever, all the way through to students making career decisions, colleges making decisions on which courses they should even offer. They do that based on our numbers, which go before the State Board of Education. The second thing I want to mention, quality information is the first. The second one is customer service. And we long ago came to the conclusion that we can have all the data, all the publications we want sitting on our shelves, and it does no one any good. So we really work hard to reach out to the kinds of presentations that I've talked about. And here's what that company in LeGrand said. They said that they decided to locate there because of the response from the community. And the direct quote was, they worked as a team and they got the information we wanted when we needed it. And again, I feel that our folks played a big role in that.
See, I think that information's skewed, though, because we have the greatest employment folks in the world located in Union County, and they're very responsive. So hopefully they're all that way statewide.
They are, Mr. Chair, I guarantee.
We got the lower quality in LeGrand, right? And we think the world of them.
You have top quality, Mr. Chair. You know him personally very well. Yeah. Okay, just turning now to page F1 in your binders. I'm not going to read you the summary of our mission statement. Debbie's already covered that. I'm not going to read you those bullets. But I do want to try to give you just a sense for each of the bullets of, so what? It's all very well to say this economic information is there, but I want to give you that, so what? What does it mean to us? So, for example, in the first one, that's how we know that unemployment rates in Senator Verger's area are about twice as high as they are in some parts of Senator Morse's. We would not know those things without our staff to compute unemployment rates. And the same with the lumber industry, the high-tech industry, the tourism industry. You hear about all these industries growing and declining and having good spots and bad spots, but we wouldn't know that stuff if we weren't doing that first bullet of the accurate and reliable information. Looking at the changes in the economic climate, who would have guessed when we started this recession that the biggest increase in unemployment would come in Representative Mavakian's area, in the Beaverton Hillsborough area? Mm-hmm. Far different than any other recession that this state has ever gone through. And we tracked that all the way through, and we were able to communicate that to different policymakers that needed to know it. It's also how we know that Representative Richardson's area is likely to be the fastest growing in the state in the next 10 years, followed closely by Senator Westland's. But if you're from Malheur, Grant, or Harney County, your growth rate's about half as fast as those two regions. And we project that out for a 10-year period. We do it every other year. It's no good, and the third bullet, it's no good as having all this information on our shelf, and we count these things, and we'll talk about that under performance measures, but we actually estimate that we had close to 1 million customer contacts, and the way we define those is the number of publications, the number of visitors to our website, the number of people in the audiences and the presentations that we give, and the number of those one-on-one customer contacts when a business calls us. So that's a million people from about 65 economist, analyst, statistician types. Of course, the web helps a lot in those, as do the publications. Do I see a question, Senator?
I'll wait till the end.
Okay. The fifth one, providing occupational and career information, I regret that Senator Carter isn't here, but it also relates somewhat to what Tracy talked about, the young mother coming in, looking at our information and seeing, oh, I have certain skills, maybe I qualify for certain jobs, and then linking my part of the employment department with the one that Tracy talked about, where she not only figures out which job she might qualify for, but she looks on our website and then goes and applies for them and gets them. So this career information is very important to schools, because we help them figure out what classes they probably should be teaching, community colleges, private career schools, and then also on the other side for students or adults as they change careers. The final one, the tailored information to particular customer groups, is very important. Again, when we serve those five companies in Washington County, Ahmed, our workforce analyst, didn't just go in and say, here's a pile of publications, have fun, or here's our web address, go look for it. He went in and said, okay, here's the question that I understand you're asking. Here's the wages that you're looking for. Here's the demographic trends that you're asking about. So that's the kind of customized thing. And I don't know if the chair has yet seen the work we did last week on that small business development idea of jobs for the unemployed. But Bill Carter and I have been emailing. And again, we'll do anything from a quick phone call to several pages of analysis to say, if this is what you're particularly interested in, we've got staff that will help pull it together. Turning to page F6, just to touch very briefly on our performance measures. As you'd expect from what I've already said, data quality and customer service are the two things that matter to us. So three of our measures look very closely at data quality. I'm definitely not going to bore you with the details on how we measure those things. Suffice to say, the first two measure the quality of the survey information that we're collecting. And without high response rates and good quality survey information coming in, nothing else we do, none of those presentations or information requests will be any good. And the third one, the revision of the employment estimates, that's based on the fact that every month we estimate employment in Oregon, and then about once a year we're able to go back and use unemployment insurance records to see, did those estimates based on a survey turn out to be pretty close to reality? And as you can see, last year we did very, very well. Incidentally, you have a direct interest in that, because if we find that our estimates were off a lot, that's the input to Tom Potowski's economic forecast. So if our estimates are off a lot, then you're going to find that Tom's numbers changed, not because the economy changed, but because our numbers changed. Unfortunately, we have a good track record of not letting that happen, but that's one of the links that we have. On the customer service side of the performance measures, we've done a lot of customer satisfaction surveys about our publications, about our presentations, about our website. One new one that we think will become the all-encompassing thing is a survey of the 15 workforce boards in the state. They are the focal point of the workforce system, and so in a very real sense, if all 15 of them respond and are happy with what we're providing and the timeliness and the quality and so on, then that will be probably the best single measure we can have. But we'll still do the satisfaction surveys on the publications. Customer contacts I've already mentioned, and the last two just break that out in a little more detail. Before closing, I would like to just address Senator Morris's question about the Department of Administrative Services, the Economic Analysis Office. I honestly believe, Senator, that there is no duplication, and I know you'd expect me to say that, but it's an honest belief. Tom Potowski and I work very closely. We know each other very well. The same was true with Paul Warner when he was in that job, if we go back a few years. There's a few things that they do, and as Debbie said, they have a very narrow focus and a small staff that focuses on particular expertise. They do the revenue projections, the prison projections, and lottery projections, and we do none of that. We don't have staff that even look at that except to see the graphs and maybe use it in our presentations. They do have an analyst who spends a lot of time on population analysis. We don't. We don't have anybody who spends time in any way duplicating what he does. In fact, we use their information and the information from Portland State University's population center. That becomes what we use for anything we do in terms of population, and of course the U.S. Census Bureau. And the final thing they do is short-term employment projections, which of course is getting closer to our area of expertise. The thing I would tell you there is that they use all of our numbers as their input, and that's why if we revise our numbers,
their results will change because what we offered to them in the beginning would have changed. We specifically do not do short-term employment projections for the distinct reason that they're already doing it. We're not going to duplicate. Even to the point that in a Department of Labor grant that we get, it requires short-term projections, and we've told the Department of Labor we are not going to duplicate this. We simply use the Tom Petowski projections as our control total, and we break out more industry detail because we have to do that for the grant. But we never duplicate the work that his staff have already done. On the other hand, just about everything I've shared with you that we do, Tom's group does not do. They do nothing below the statewide level. They do nothing in terms of 10-year projections going out for career planning and so on like that. They don't do anything really with unemployment rates, except, again, using our information. Tom and I probably 3 or 4 times a year give presentations together, and it's not a problem because he's got his expertise, I've got mine, and we kind of bounce off each other in terms of the presentation material. I'd be happy to go into more detail with you now or one-on-one if you'd like it. But that my quick answer is, I really honestly believe there's no duplication, but a lot of collaboration.
Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Johnson.
Thank you. That was a very comprehensive answer to Senator Morris. I still am struggling to understand the relationship between you and Oregon Economic and Community Development and whether or not customer service there, based on the data that you have, is more accidental or organized. And I'm trying to just figure out how that information translates over in your information in some formalized way to that agency. And I keep thinking of an example that somebody gave me the other day about a company in Northern California trying to make the decision to come to Oregon or to stay in Northern California. And the way the story was related to me, folks in Oregon said, give us a call if you need anything. Folks in California dispatched somebody from the governor's office in a helicopter to go up and talk to the company with all the relevant data. I'm trying to figure out how we're using the critical information that you're developing in some systematic way with Oregon Economic and Community Development, because I'm trying to figure out if a customer calls, what's the first portal right by which a prospective business enters the state of Oregon? Do they call you? Do they call Oregon Economic and Community Development? What's the formal overlap that makes sure both of you are not working on the same customer in parallel but separate universes? I need something a little more reassuring that your high-quality data is being utilized by another agency appropriately, effectively, and timely.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, let me answer this two ways. One, it's kind of a... It depends on the business and who they know, who they go to, whom they call, whether they call economic development or they get on a website or they call local economic development. A lot of businesses are talking to the local area. They'll call a chamber of commerce or a local like SEDCOR in Salem. We have in each of our regions and connected to each of our offices a team of folks for the very purpose of who get together for the purpose of being able to share information and ensure that nothing's dropped through the cracks. So those teams, the core of those teams in each workforce region, include the Employment Department, the local economic development agency, the state economic development representative, the community college, and the workforce Title 1B, Workforce Investment Act people. So the Employment Department is talking on an ongoing basis with the local economic development and state economic development people in each of those regions. So that's one way that they share information and bring information to the table. Our workforce analysts that Graham talked about, stationed all around the state, again, are very much involved in each of the communities and know what's going on. At the state level, as Graham mentioned, he works on an ongoing basis with Ron Fox and the regional development officers. And I meet, again, in a team setting with those folks as well as the governor's staff and the community college and workforce development department staff and so forth. So we do a lot of cross-discussion then to ensure that when there's information needed, we can get that. What I would suggest, because I think Ron Fox or somebody from Economic Development would probably be more appropriate to answer from their point of view how that we get them the information, how they use it, or what kind of connections are made. And I could ask Ron or somebody from over there to join us tomorrow at the hearing and maybe address those kinds of issues if you'd be interested in that.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With your indulgence, I would be, because I'm trying to figure out if I'm Betsy's Better Baking in Sacramento and I come up and I call somebody in the state, I call OECDD,
mm-hmm.
at what level then are my needs triaged by this kind of group processing that you've discussed? And who ultimately takes charge of servicing the questions that I have if I'm going to move my 200 employees to Coos Bay?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think probably it would be best for Ron to respond to some of those questions. The Employment Department isn't the lead agency usually in these kinds of situations. It's one of the economic development, either local or state, organizations that take charge. So they would be best to answer the questions, and we can coordinate that.
Thank you. However the chair deems it appropriate to get the information, I just would like to catch that on a list somewhere.
I think that's a very, very good point we need to pursue. The question I'm struggling with is, do we bring Ron Fox in today, or do we bring you folks into the Economic and Community Development Department's discussion?
It doesn't matter to me.
But there does need to be a discussion on that. Part of the struggle I'm having is I need convincing that the Economic and Community Development Department's strategy is tied truly to the information that you are providing,
mm-hmm.
and that we are meeting the needs that you folks are putting forth. So, but I'm not sure. Let me think through that if I might.
However you work it out is fine.
Thank you. I've got Senator Verger, and then I'm going to go to Representative Avakian.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This week, a representative from the Bandon Dunes Golf Course told me that they will, in the very near future, hire hundreds of full-time jobs. I'm curious that they already have several golf courses there and have already hired and certainly temporary help, like 300 caddies in the summer. But on these new ones, that changes the employment numbers, obviously, in Coos County. But are you brought into that in assisting them with interviews, or how do you connect people that are looking for jobs? Because that's your mission, is to get the person to the qualified job. Now, when these jobs get posted, can you explain the process for me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, we have our local field offices manage that process. In your area, Kathy Morgan is in charge of both Curry and Coos County's field offices. We encourage people to come in and register on our new iMatch skills system, the web-based skills-based system that we talked about earlier. We also have business representatives and account representatives who get to know individual businesses and industries very, very well so that they can identify the workforce needs that those people have. So we will have, in a situation like that, we would have an employee go out and talk to the people at Bandon Dunes, the HR people at Bandon Dunes, to see if we can get them to list their jobs with us, tell them what our services are, help them figure out what it is what kind of services they need. If they want us to do the screening, for example, so that they don't get hundreds and hundreds of not very well qualified people walking in the door, we can do that. We can provide interview rooms, do some pre-interviewing for them, a whole range of services from simply listing their jobs and having it on our system so people can self-refer all the way to screening and coordinating the interview process itself, whatever the company wants. So we would first thing we would do is send somebody out to Bandon Dunes to talk to the HR people and see what it is we can do. And again, all these services are paid for through employer taxes, so we call them prepaid. There's no additional fee involved. It is free to them in that sense.
Thank you.
And I will send somebody out to Bandon Dunes right away.
Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually curious about your coordination with OECDD as well, but don't feel the need to cover that again. But internally within your own department, once you identify these trends through your research, how do you coordinate with other pieces of your department, such as the Business and Employment Services, and are you nimble enough that you can shift resources to certain areas of the state that need the help?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buckin, I think we are pretty nimble. One of the good things is that we're all physically located. The leadership of the three unemployment insurance, employment service, and research program areas literally are on the same floor. We do have personally very strong ties, so a lot of communication goes that way. Another thing that happens, and these folks behind will probably laugh when I say this, but I do push my information at them in PowerPoints and in presentations to our executive team, and I have a reputation for doing that. Probably to get a level of detail that you're thinking, I can't think of an example for where we've maybe moved some staff from one office to another on a permanent basis because we projected 5 years down the road this might happen.
Mr. Chair,
more in real time.
I'm just wondering if you have a formal method within your department for targeting your research, other than you just going out and beating it over people's head to try and get them to recognize it. If there's a formal process for seeing that your resources are allocated to the places that need the help.
You want to take that? Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Atkin, the workforce analysts and regional economists are two groups of our staff who are out there in the field offices, 25 of them, all across the state, and they're working very, they're in the one stop, the employment offices. So they're working very closely with the field managers out there to know what's going on in Hermiston, in the Wright County, or in Union County, or in Beaverton, and so on. So even within my research group, we do have 25 staff out there. Is that getting at your question?
I think so, but I think you're going to add something to that.
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bakken, I was just going to add that their job is to know what's going on in their community and what kind of information is needed, so it's a real good back-and-forth kind of thing. Again, having our staff, not just the workforce analysts and regional economists, but our field office managers and staff as well, so involved in the community that they know what their community partners need to know in order to inform the research agenda that Graham and his folks have. So it's a really good back and forth. We've got feelers out all across the state to know who needs to know what, and even if they don't know, they need to know it. We can come up, our folks are able to recognize that and develop the information that's necessary.
Well, we have about 20 minutes left, and we still have three issues. We need to look at the reductions list, 10% reductions list, and then review priorities, and then we'll we'll have an opportunity for any last-minute questions.
Hey, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll start with the priorities list because it sets the context for the reductions list. If you'll turn to page G8, following that is one of those big sheets that folds out that gives you our priority lists. Just to let you know how we did this, back in each of the program areas sections, each program area set up a list of priorities, and you will find those with each of the program areas. This page that follows G8 is the entire department's program priority list put together. We did this, we've got, I think, 22 areas, and for a department this large, I think it was a good balance between very, very high level and the kind of detail that we could get into if we broke it down very specifically. What we tried to do was first take a look at the governor's principles, five principles, and connect what we our top priorities to those. As I go through our lists, each of our program areas addresses the governor's principles in one way or another. But we started out with the kids, the basic educational needs, and the need to keep Oregonians safe. as our top priority, and that's why you see the Child Care Division's licensing and regulation of child care to be our number one priority. This is the place where we do have a life and death connection. If kids don't have safe child care, they're in danger, and so child care licensing is our top priority. Then we go down through programs that provide Oregonians with basic daily needs. That's the unemployment insurance piece. And the number three is the taxes to support that. We can't provide uninsurance benefits that support people's basic daily needs without collecting the taxes that pay those. Our fourth is, and I'm not going to walk through all 22 of these, but I just want to give you an idea of what it is we looked at when we did this. Our fourth, again, is the safety, keeping Oregonians safe. It's implied consent hearings. That is keeping drunk drivers off the road. That's the Department of Motor Vehicles hearings that are done through the Office of Administrative Hearings. And then we get into the economic development and business climate kinds of programs that we provide through research, through business employment services, and on down. One of the reasons why number five, our research, is so high is that nobody else does the kind of thing that Graham and his staff do. Some of our priorities tend to fall a little bit lower because there may be other places to get a similar service, not exactly the kinds of service. But Workforce and Economic Research Division's programs come up fairly high because nobody else does those kinds of things. So that's how we determined what our program priorities are. As every agency will tell you, it's like choosing between your children. Who's your favorite, and it's very, very difficult. And because the infrastructure, one supports the other, it's also difficult to figure it out. But I think we've got a fairly good list of, without nickel and diming or taking pieces out of individual positions, a good way to set up those priorities. I can move to the reduction, the 10% reduction, unless you have questions on the board.
Well, really quick, Debbie, would it be possible for you to just provide us with some type of executive summary of the Wagner-Pizer Act?
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Well, a common theme throughout all of this, and it'd be great if...
Just a sentence. Wagner-Pizer is the act that provides federal money to support business and employment services. Comes out of the federal UI administrative money that is paid by employers, and over the last 15 years it has continued to shrink. It's been flat. There's been no inflation, no cost of living, no work adjustment. So it covers about a third of our business employment services and research right now. But yeah, we can give you some more detail on that. And there are some special programs there too.
I'm going to add to that also, if we could get information on the Workforce Investment Act. And again, yes, indeed. An executive summary.
We've got that.
Something that's
yep.
Just kind of give us an overview.
I've got a one pager or a two pager on both those issues that we'll bring tomorrow for you. The reduction options then follow page G18. It's a one-page, a fold-out page, but just a one-pager. We did a couple of things. We took a look at our priorities and tried to hook those two up see what it is that we could do without if we needed to. We also had to balance fund sources. We have about $3 million of general fund in child care, and that's the only general fund we have. And so we've got, we do have a $300,000 reduction showing for general fund. The rest of it we had to balance between the other fund and the federal fund and different fund sources and so forth, including our non-limited benefit money. So you'll see the very last one is reduce UI benefits by $114 million. That's simply a 10% cut to what we expect to have in unemployment benefits. We did have to take a look at some of our higher priorities and pull pieces out of them so that the business and employment services is a very high priority for us, our core services. We did pull out kiosks, which we could pare down in some areas of the state to, if we had to had to reduce funding for to meet the 10% requirement. Following that sheet, and the first, if you'll turn to appendix, the first page on the after the appendix tab is a more detailed explanation of what each of these reductions is. So, for example, the kiosks, we would cut $300,000 out of the kiosks program, and that would pull kiosks out of the more populated areas where people have access to other ways of getting the information that the kiosks provide, such as field offices and internets. So we've done it that way, an attempt to pare down slowly so that the bulk of the programs wouldn't be damaged as we went down through our unemployment or our reduction options. And match them up to our priorities.
Any questions? Senator Johnson.
Just a detail question. Employment-related daycare for the $9 million that you have from federal funds in that program, how many people do you serve? If you could, I don't expect you to know right now, but if you could get that, that would be great.
We'll get that information for you, Senator.
I think we're all digesting the information you provided us. Well, we still have a few minutes. Would you mind taking a moment and sharing with the committee the partnership that you folks have developed with the Small Business Development Center, particularly here in Salem, and the work that's going on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have a program that that the feds offered to states. Each state doesn't have to implement this program, but we chose to a few years ago. It's called the Self-Employment Assistance Program. That program allows people who qualify, and that is UI claimants who look like they're going to run out of benefits because they can't get a job, to develop their own business while they continue to draw their unemployment insurance benefits. They have to go through a number of requirements. That is, they have to have an idea that is viable as a small business. And to ensure that, we send them to the Small Business Development Centers to receive counseling and education on how to do a business plan and how to figure out their market and all those kinds of things. So we have been unable to advertise or expand this business or this program very much during this last recession because the Small Business Development Centers don't have the staffing to provide the counseling that we need. We think we could probably bump this program up quite a bit, particularly in the Portland area, but all around the state if we had the staff at the SBDCs. I think it would be very popular, and we have some good examples of folks who have gone through this program and have really interesting niche businesses that they've developed. So what we are doing with the Salem TED Center, which is the Small Business Development Center here connected to Chemeketa, we provided them with a little bit of money out of a special pot of money that we have, again, out of Wagner-Peiser money, to hire a half-time business counselor. And then we are in this service area advertising the program by sending letters to unemployment insurance claimants who qualify and seeing how many of those folks we get back and then send to we can send them to business counseling at the SBDC. So that's the partnership we have with those folks. The chair asked us to take a look at what that might look like if we expanded that across the state. And so we looked at about 19 SBDCs, which I think is what we've got around the state, and figured it would take a little over $200,000 or $700,000 to provide that kind of half-time business counseling at each of the SBDCs. That's a kind of a ballpark figure. But I think it's an interesting program. It's a viable program. We can bring you some samples of what kinds of successes we've had. And the only barrier, the only thing that's in the way of it, I think, is the capacity of the SBDCs to provide the counseling to ensure that the entrepreneurial ideas are viable.
I appreciate that. I've had a chance to do some homework on this, and I work with SBDCs in a professional way, but I had no clue about the self-employment assistance program, and when I heard about it, I delved a little further, and it really does seem like a good partnership to be had. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'd like to drill down a little farther on the ideas are viable. I mean, this is a reoccurring theme that I think once again happens in Oregon Economic and Community Development. And I have a constituent right now who is interested in having one-third of OECD's budget given over to inventors that are working on groundbreaking inventions. What I'm trying to tease out here is where are the filters to decide what's viable before expending an enormous amount of time in looking at somebody's great idea. And I don't discount the fact that, Mr. Edison had some great ideas and they turned out just fine. But where are the filters put on to make sure that we're spending resources wisely in developing ideas that have some possibility of moving forward?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, the ones we use are the people at the SBDCs who understand how to market an idea, how to develop a business plan, how to analyze the market area and the customer base for a particular idea or approach. Again, I would have to go back to the OECD folks to find out what more they would do in such a situation to ensure that the money spent on an entrepreneurial venture is worth spending. I'm assuming too that they're always in touch with venture capitalists and people who, for a living, fund good ideas. That's probably where that filter is. For our particular program, it's the Small Business Development Center folks. But I think that's probably much, much broader when you get into OECD's responsibilities.
Well, and I think adding to that, I think the role of the SBDC is to serve as a filter, and every citizen ought to be able to get at least an hour of advising from an SBDC if they seek it. And if the SBDC advisors are doing their job, they ought to be able to be very forthcoming in reminding the prospective entrepreneur that the idea has a lot of work to do to get it from a hunk of coal into a diamond. And I think that's part of the role of the SBDC. And at the same time, I think you've got to be careful because you want to make sure that if there is a partnership between the two, that the employment department isn't just, I'm going to use this word and I probably shouldn't, dumping off folks when in reality what we're hoping to do is try and find some of those diamonds in the lumps of coal. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Graham Slatter regarding... said that you that I believe it was you that said that you're getting about a million hits over the course of the year, including your internet and brochures being handed out. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson's right. A million customer contacts, adding everything together.
Okay, I found that intriguing because to count how many brochures one would hand out or how many people might hit their internet is not exactly I don't see that as being as significant as other things. So out of your approximately million hits of customer contacts, roughly do you know how many are not related to hits on the internet and brochures that might be handed out? Trying to get to the so what that you were trying to ask.
Right.
I have a lot of FTC or FTEs here. We have 25 employees across the state in employment offices, which I assume that they're providing information for. I'm wondering, and I'll find out as time goes on, about the overlap that's taking place with what OECD says that they're doing and other things, because your area is kind of one of those areas that there may be some siloing that isn't really apparent yet.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, just to give you a very quick overview of our area, roughly 20 to 25% of our people are paid by the Bureau of Labor Statistics simply to do those surveys, the basic surveys that produce the information that we then can share with the million customer contacts. So in a sense, those people aren't really in that customer contact game, although some of them certainly do contact customers. The actual numbers for the different types of things that you're asking about, and I'm turning pages here frantically, the rough numbers were 350,000 visitors to the website, somewhere around 450,000, maybe half a million as far as the publications. And one of those that brings it up very, very high is that we do a careers newspaper every year that goes to every high school, community college, workforce center. We also do thousands of them in Spanish. Then we add on the presentations, which rough numbers is 10 to 12,000 people in an audience. And then I add on those individual companies, private sector, job seekers, whoever they are, that we deal with. And those are usually in the 8 to 10,000 range also. So I can give you the precise numbers. I've got them. I'd already folded my binder up, but those are close probably for what you need.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
The last thing I would add is over my professional career, very short as it may be, in working with Graham and his shop, they've been absolutely excellent in getting us the information we need. And quite often, when a port is asking for information, they could be saying we're meeting with the company in the next 48 hours, and we've got to know XYZ. And they've been just absolutely phenomenal in getting the information and representing the state in a very professional manner when they do sit in on those meetings. And so I think you're to be complimented in the entire department.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, we went through this pretty darn quick. You know, Senator Johnson, see, you got to just put the reins on me tomorrow. Well, with that said, I think we'll adjourn, and hopefully tomorrow will be a time of having questions. And I'm going to think through and talk with you, Senator Johnson, on the best way to bring economic development forward to make sure we get the most value out of that conversation. That's it. We're adjourned.
Thank you.